This is an interview with Professor Gwen Andrew, and we're talking about the provost at Michigan State, and you were mentioning one of the Larry Boger.
Yeah. He was very good at his job, I thought. He was heavy on delegating to deans. Of course, he'd been dean of agriculture, and he probably thought the deans ought to do what they're doing without any great deal of interference. So you didn't see a lot of him. It was up to you to make the appointments and go in with your notions, and he was always very good at accepting innovative ideas, as far as I could tell. Give you an example. I was knew I was going to have a chunk of money left. I'm going to say $50,000, I don't know what it was, $50,000, $100,000 or something at the end of the year. And I said to him, I'd like to give that to you, and you keep it for me so I can use it next year or sometime in the future. I just want it in the bank. He said, fine, I'll do it. He said, I need some money to buy sousaphones for Arts and Letters, the music place, so I'll take your dough and we'll do that. Mm-hmm. So that worked very nicely for both of us. And that's what I mean. He was willing to do those things. Now, when he left the job, they got very upset about my wad of money over there and finally said, you've got to use it. We're not going to hold it for you anymore.
Use it or lose it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But anyway, that I thought he was good at that. Winder was good. He followed Boger. He was especially good at codifying and at developing an institutional memory. And he was personally committed to the development of the institution. Those are his great strengths. He was kind of trapped with the Mackey, you know, when they were trying to downsize or save money or whatever. He.
What was his background?
He was out of psychology.
He was psychology.
Yeah,
okay.
In fact, he was the dean of social science
before
I was, and I took over from him, and he had a very well-organized college, obviously, when I got there, so that was. And he had the person that preceded him, Lou McQuitty, had been an army colonel or something, and he was very well organized. I guess Winder was a bomber pilot, so they all had all those things. But in any case,
you had served at the University of Wisconsin.
Yeah, and he. But that was his style was very close to the chest, as they faster work with this. I'll cover up my microphone, but. He didn't tell people much about what he was doing, and people got upset about that. But nevertheless, as I say, he was a good codifier and organizer and so on. Then David Scott followed him. I was on the search committee to get David Scott, and I thought he'd be a good choice, and I spent lots of time trying to undermine the other candidates. But we had some pretty good ones on the list. Most of them became provosts someplace or other.
Mm-hmm.
But his style, he was very much a person of style. He had a lot of class. Knew how to use, how to be the, what do I want to say, the cultural kind of provost and so on. If he were going to make remarks about someone, they were always very nicely done. They weren't dry stuff, things that he prepared and so on.
He was a scientist, wasn't he?
Yes, he was, physicist. And then he was a bit of a fly-by-night in the sense that he was always very much concerned about his own ambition and where he was going to go and so on. So he hadn't been provost very long before he started looking for presidencies. I knew about that because I was serving as one of his referees or references, however you want to put it. So you knew when he was doing this, and he did. He wasn't there very long before he was at that. But he was a good guy, but he had no, and I liked working with him, but he had no sense of the social sciences. We used to have what we called Project David Scott or something like that. And we tried to get him to understand them. But he was very hard to teach because he had his notions about the humanities and so forth, and he didn't know where to put social science as far as I could see, and it wasn't a big concern to him.
Mm-hmm.
But he did like the egalitarian notions of the social scientist. I've heard him say he was a socialist, and he probably had some of that thing about him. But anyway, that's pretty much my story of administrators.
Did you find among those one that was particularly easy to work with, or that you fit your style, or that you had the
Well, I think Boger was the easiest to work with, but as I say, he wasn't there very long. So,
uh-huh.
And had Mackey come in as president with Boger as provost, I don't know what would have happened. Mm-hmm. And as I say, they had rather different ideas about, different styles, and I suspect different ideas about how to do those things, so I don't know. Boger would be much more authoritarian than most provosts were, in a way, but in another way he wasn't, because he did so much delegating. So there you are, but what he wanted, he wanted.
Mm-hmm. The some of your own research, how would you describe your own research and scholarly work?
Well, I was interested in systems theory and played out in formal organizations, but I'd have trouble calling it terribly scholarly. It's not overly scholarly, let's say. I did quite a bit of publishing, and like everybody else, or maybe more than everybody else, there were a few good things, and a lot of them, it wouldn't have mattered if the world had never seen them. They were heavily applied and relevant to wherever I was. So when I was in the mental health business, I did much more in that area. Usually, these organizational emphases were in most of these. But then when I was director of social work, I did much more on how to organize schools of social work and develop curriculum and stuff for those. And now I'm on the Board of Medicine for the state, so I've been doing papers on how to organize boards and their functions and so on. I suppose I think the best stuff I didn't. Well, I did some speeches I like, I guess. I did one for Phi Beta Kappa here that I thought was pretty good, and one for Phi Kappa Phi. So those, mm-hmm. the speaking things I used to like to do. I guess that's about all there is on that.
Have you, so you're, did you, in terms of scholarship, the articles, conference papers, what, mm-hmm. which were the main emphasis, monographs, what would you say was the main, or your best?
Well, I think I was a better speaker than I was anything else, okay. But I also, as I say, I published papers mm-hmm. and monographs, those things, and as I say, some of those were reasonable and some of them probably were not great.
In terms of teaching and views about students, maybe good to talk a little bit about that. What'd you like about the classroom?
Oh, I like show-off, so it's always fun to teach, although teaching is hard work. I think people who haven't done it don't realize how hard a work it really is. And that's one thing I thought when I was as a dean or whatever. I always tried to teach at least one course a year, just so I knew what was going on, because I think if you didn't do that, you didn't know what was going on in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
So I used to like to do that. I happen to think big lectures, by the way, are as good as small classrooms, so on. I got thinking back again about my own background, and I think I had probably four professors, three of them were Wisconsin and one here, who I thought were superb teachers. Two of those had huge lectures. One of them had a good-sized lecture that was here with maybe 50 people in the class, and then another one at Wisconsin who had one of these small 20, 25 max. And they were all superb because they were good teachers. It didn't make a difference the size of the class and so on. So
who were they?
Who were they?
Yeah.
One of them was Kiekhofer at Wisconsin, and the other one was Norman Cameron. And then here, the philosopher, God, what's his name? I never can remember. I'll have to look it up if we're going to do it. It's in one of these books, because one of my great claims to fame is I ended up being published in a book that's with him. Hmm. But he went off to become president of Sarah Lawrence College. And he's the one with the small class, and he was very good.
Here at Michigan State?
No, that's
Wisconsin.
Wisconsin, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then here at Michigan State, another philosopher, he was a philosopher of science, Yeah, I'll have to look his name up too.
Okay.
It's terrible to say I know all four and I can't think of who they were. Mm-hmm. But Kiko for Cameron.
I know that's
I'll look it up.
Put you on the spot.
I don't mean to do that. I'll look them up.
Do you think lecturing's a lost art? Good lecturing?
I doubt it. I think people that want to do it can do a good job with it. And if they're no good, they're hopeless.
With a large audience. That's the only unfortunate thing.
But it's interesting that those four people, one of them was in economics, Kiekhofer, and then Cameron was in psychology. And then the guy here in philosophy of science is obviously in the small group. Small course man, it was a small group, but that guy was a philosopher. So those are kind of the areas where I had my really good teaching.
Mm-hmm. Was there any particular classroom technique that you liked to use and used effectively?
I liked to lecture.
Mm-hmm.
Although usually I had classes of a size that you really had to lecture.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't get a lot of experience with the smaller groups. I would say my one major teaching discovery, if that's what the word is that I always gave blue book written exams, essay exams, and I would give them a choice of maybe two or three questions, but they'd pick one, and they had to answer the question on one side of an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper. Now they've got however long you have for exams. What is it, a couple mm-hmm. hours or something?
2 hours now.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And they spent their time on organizing whatever they did with it, and then I would get this thing, and if it was longer than that, I didn't read it. I didn't read anything longer than that one page.
Mm-hmm.
And it works beautifully because they do a much better job of putting what they think together. They can do all the fooling around. They're not just writing to impress you with space filling, and they're not writing just as they think it out,
mm-hmm.
they put it together, and it really, so I decided that's the only way to examine people.
That's interesting, yeah.
Yeah, it worked very well.
Concision is important.
Yeah, and you can also read them and do a better job of grading when
mm-hmm.
you do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you have grad assistants with you at that time?
No, I never had a grad assistant.
Okay, So the essay writing, you placed emphasis on that in terms of
examination and so on. Yeah,
yeah.
That was the style.
What, in terms of describing students over the years, maybe from the beginning of your career here to toward the end, did you see any qualitative differences, or is that just the whole idea of are there any generational differences that you saw in the students?
I didn't see any qualitative differences. You always have a batch of them that are very good and a batch that are fairly average and then a few that are really quite bad. I suspect they didn't write as well toward the end of that period, although you've got to remember now I was teaching at a time originally late 60s, very early 70s, that most of my teaching, other than I say this once a year thing, tended to be at the time where it was very difficult to teach them because there was no way they were going to sit still and teach or talk or, you know, they so on. So that was a tough period for all teachers. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about me. Mm-hmm. But my impression is that they became more interested in learning as time went on, but I think that was just the times, not the students per se. But I have relatively few observations about them because as I went on, I taught less and less, I guess. I used to see them when they were in trouble. I'd come to the dean's office and that kind of thing. My favorite tale about that is the kid that came with his father. And his father explained to me that the kid was on a swimming scholarship, and that he had other kids in the family, and the implication was if I'd look on this kid a little more favorably instead of letting him flunk out, that they would send the other kids here, and people really think that matters, which it doesn't. But he went on, and the kid, I guess, finally told me the story. He had signed up for a psychology class, and he had never shown up. And he, or maybe he was there once, and he had failed because he hadn't taken any of the tests or any of these things. Well, he said he had, and then he discovered that right after the classes started in the fall, he had to go off swimming or whatever. And when he came back, he went to class faithfully, and he didn't know why there were any problems with this. And then he discovered much later that the rooms had been changed, and here he was going to a poetry class. I thought, if he can't tell that difference, he's probably not the best student going.
Maybe he's in the wrong field.
Yeah, I guess so.
Our department chair, he had three generations one time. He had grandparents show up with the student.
Great, and
he wasn't swayed by their by their numbers anyway.
Yeah, it doesn't do much for him.
Did you, the students politically in the 60s obviously were were active politically and that sort of thing. Did, that did you see that either intruding on the learning experience or did
Oh
or,
yes, or and in
it
the
did
70s,
in the 60s.
Yeah,
yeah,
and late 60s, early 70s here. This is a little behind all the rumpus stuff. No, I think it had a tremendous effect on it. I have one student who's a good friend, and I like to tell him that he went through at the time when nobody learned anything.
It's like, I'm a historian, it's like history without facts during that period.
Yeah. So.
Dates aren't important, they told that whole generation.
Yeah, I think so.
The, during your career at MSU, were you involved in local community activities?
Oh, yeah, I was on local boards like the Family Service Agency, the United Way. I was on the State Board of Corrections, a governor's appointment to that, and I'm now on the Board of Medicine, a governor's appointment. So I was in a lot of that kind of
stuff. Which governor first appointed you? Was it Milliken? Or?
Yeah, Milliken appointed me to the corrections, and then Engler to the Board of Medicine. And in both those cases, it wasn't because I was in their political camp. It so happens I'm a Democrat, although I know I voted for Milliken a time or two. But anyhow, that was because somebody knew me and wanted me to be on the board, the director of the departments that were working with these commissions. And Kathy Wilbur, for example, would be the reason I'd be on the Board of Medicine, that she'd been a trustee and knew me through that. And the guy that had worked with me in mental health and research was over in corrections at the time that they appointed me to that and so forth. So that's where those things came from. And then the United Way, I don't remember how I got appointed to that kind of stuff.
They tap the busiest people lots of times.
I think they're more visible or something, I suppose. But... Oh, as far as the town gown kind of thing, there weren't a lot of issues there, except, as I say, whatever went on with these particular appointments that I held. I do remember they used to have a kind of an evening lecture and banquet, and people from the community, I suppose Chamber of Commerce and God knows what else, and people from the university, largely administrators, a lot of people, would go to this thing, and you'd get kind of paired up with people and so on, and that was fine. But one year they had the man who was president of Hillsdale come, and that was the year that the town people had planned the program, and they invited him. And he was a very staunch conservative, and one of the most conservative people in the community was in charge of planning this thing. He got up and gave this lecture, and then, introduction, I should say, about the man, and then the man gave his lecture. And he's the guy who wouldn't take any federal money, couldn't because he wasn't going to have any affirmative action and so forth.
The George Roach, I think.
Yeah, I guess that was his name. And at the end, they were giving him this standing ovation, everybody in the place. There were two women in the audience. One of them was Gwen Andrew, and the other is another gal, and those two women did not stand for the standing ovation, so that's my recollection of town gown, I guess. But usually it was a pleasant enough idea.
The in your retirement, have you had any continuing university contact or work within the university? Sports activities you've attended? Were you interested at all in that? Or
no, I don't do much with them now. Mm-hmm. Since I finally quit. See, I retired about three times.
Oh, three times.
Well, I retired from social science and then from this kind of interim thing with the nurses and then from the human health thing. So, I don't know, I guess I'd had about enough and they'd had enough. I did this bit with McPherson for a while, and that was obviously a short-term thing, and there are other people doing it too. But I haven't had much to do with them since then.
Mm-hmm. Did you think back about the faculty and staff that you worked with? Any that you would like to mention as certainly were very important in either your career or that you enjoyed working with? Or lots of times when somebody's preparing a history, frequently we forget some of the key figures. They sometimes go nameless. I think that's one of the things we're trying to do in this project, is to put the names on some of those people that have made important contributions to the university, and yet frequently the archives don't bring those names out.
Yeah, and it's really hard to do that when you're interviewing and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
did you have any staff members that worked with you that you think were just, you know, made your job better or made it?
Oh, I had a lot of good staff members. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about that. I was trying to think what kind of things I could tell you about staff. One thing I noticed is the tremendous difference between what I call, I guess you'd call it the North Campus, I always say on the other side of the tracks, the Berkey Hall side, the administration mm-hmm. building, all that across the river there, mm-hmm. the core colleges, that stuff. The difference between that group and the medical group, it seemed to me, you know, remarkable. It's almost like two different places that, so it was interesting to be able to work in those. Now, there's a great commonality. They've got the ideas of the boundaries. They got the appointments, the tenure, all this kind of stuff. But they really, how can I put this thing? It's almost like the College of Social Science is less autonomy-minded, I guess is the way to put it. The people in there, now they want their way, there's no doubt about that. But the medical thing is very difficult. Well, somebody once said to me, it must be very difficult for you to sit there and do what you're doing and know what needs to be done and not be able to do it. And that's exactly what it's like, because they have this heavy proportion of people that are the clinical faculty who earn their own salaries or large parts of their own salaries and so on. And
through grants or?
No, they go out and do practice and take care of patients and stuff. Mm-hmm. They don't get as many grants as they should as a medical school, but that makes them believe that they really own it more than they do, and they don't grasp a lot of the nuances of being at a university, I guess is the way to put it. Now, I don't mean to do this in a critical way, because I think they're just very different. Mm-hmm. They come up differently and so on, but they see that as their resources, whereas department faculty, school faculty may think it's their resources in the sense it's their department, but they don't somehow own the income and so on as these guys do over in medicine, human medicine and osteopathic. So those were very different experiences, and I'm not doing a very good job of describing them for you, but I can't get a key piece here that would do it. Except I think it does rest a lot on the extent to which they are earning money and therefore believe it's their dough. I used to say that they have a practice of pooling their liabilities and segregating their assets, and that's kind of the way they operate. Yeah. But you see, you don't have that kind of problem over in the
hearts and letters
and that stuff. But in any case,
much on the traditional department.
Yeah. Now, who was good? Well, I think I've kind of told you about people who's went along, so
sure.
You get some sense
mm-hmm.
of who's good and who isn't.
Mm-hmm.
as far as the deans go, some of them were good and some of them were quite bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the bad ones usually probably lasted about as long as the good ones. I don't know. Wilkinson was a good vice president for finance or whatever they called him, I thought. You don't know as much about that part.
Mm-hmm.
At least I didn't. I don't think most of them do. But I think a lot of the deans were not very, didn't really comprehend how to manage their resources. So they tended to dole them out, and then they didn't know where they were next year because they'd given away everything they
mm-hmm.
had. So those were the ones that weren't quite as good, or the ones that couldn't get their faculty to do anything. But I don't want to name names I thought weren't good. And
I understand.
and as I say, there were some pretty good ones. I always thought Sullivan was an excellent dean.
Richard Sullivan?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he became associate provost. Now, I knew him as dean and then as associate provost, and I thought he was pretty impressive. The deans of medicine. Well, to some extent, can't remember the man's name. What was the guy that preceded Bill Abbott as dean? I'm going to have to look these names up for you. Don Weston. Don Weston, always talked to me as though we talked alike. We seemed to have very similar ideas. But then he'd go back and he'd never pull it off, and I didn't know what he was doing, why he didn't just get it done. Well, after I got over there for a while, I realized that he didn't want to stand up to these guys that were going to give him trouble, and he didn't do it, and they didn't want him to do things, so he didn't pull them off. But his heart was in the right place, let's put it that way.
Now, were you dean at the time when there was an attack on nursing? Or the
mm-hmm.
talk of...
Yeah, I was.
The talk of the abolition of the...
I was dean of social science.
Social science.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
That's when Mackey was going to dump that college, and then, of course, they got all the folks outside to defend them and so on. I don't know if you could have got rid of that school. When I took over as dean of human ecology, I was asked centrally if there was a way to do anything with that college, because that had become an anachronism, because it really was a woman's college and you didn't need that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now I think they're doing different things, which is a whole other story. But I saw no way for them to do anything with that college. It was full of alumni that were wives of people in the farm community that were really significant people, some of the trustees and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't have any chance there. And I'm not sure whether it would have been a good idea to do it or not. I would say that somewhere in here I was making some notes about the university itself. Is there another question here? Or did I? The thing that has to do with, I guess it had to do with changes and so forth. And I would say that during the time I was here it is major changes. The University College demise was probably one of the biggest ones that occurred when I was dean, when they took out the college and then they finally took out the departments and so on. I'm not sure that was a good idea. At the time I thought it was a good idea, and the disadvantage of it was that people were in University College and their colleagues tended to look down on them, but actually when we got the Department of Social Science out of that college, there were people in there that had excellent degrees from very good places, and I have no reason to assume they weren't good teachers. But I think it may have been a good idea to break up the college itself or some way get those units related more to their respective colleges.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure it was a good idea to shut down those departments. Now, they tried to solve that with integrative studies or whatever they call it, but that was kind of a soporific at the time they did it, and the deans came up with the scheme how to do that, so we made it so weak that I doubt if it's doing a great deal. I don't know that. It may be fine because I haven't been there since. But I'm just not sure that was a good idea to split that up. The other major change that occurred during my time was the kind of catastrophe in the social sciences themselves, because they became guilty, if that's the word, about some of their theories, and they became less theory, and they moved from science to social issues. Now, I see nothing wrong with social issues. I kind of believe in those myself, worrying about them and so on. But I used to keep saying to them, let's get the science back in social science in this thing and do that bit. And I would say that was a big change that occurred, so that what had been one of the top leading colleges, I think, has had short shrift from the provost office, in part by its own doing of these kind of, we can't stick with functionalism, we can't stick with that, or as Winder once said to me, the psychology people weren't as good because they got lost from theory and so on. So those things were, but those were not just MSU, those were all over things. Mm-hmm. I suppose I'd give you a characterization of myself, how's that?
Okay.
All right.